Closing Thoughts. The 19th talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 30, 2006 at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This is our last session for the quarter and then for the year. Because this is the last session, it just didn't make any sense for me to just go one more inch through the outline. I will be glad to entertain any further comments or questions on the section on spiritual gifts that we finished last week, so we can talk about that. Otherwise, I want to go over one little topic here, and then I think just open it up to any comments, any questions, any topics that you want to kick around here. This is kind of going over old ground a little bit, but in a slightly different way, such that it might be instructive or helpful. Jody was asking me the question, if someone were to come to you and ask you about Christianity, or why are you a Christian, or why should I be a Christian, or what do I have to do to be a Christian, something like that, where you're faced with an evangelistic situation, an evangelistic occasion, what would you talk about? And in other words, what really are the essentials that people need to grasp if they're going to come to saving faith? So what I've done is I've boiled it down to what I call the six essential principles of salvation according to the biblical worldview. And I thought I'd go over that and just make some comments about that. So a lot of this won't be new if you've stayed with this series throughout. This won't be particularly new. So I won't have a lot to say coming in on this. I'll just read through it and then invite your comments and your questions. So number one, I am a creature created by a powerful creator who is the author of all reality. As my creator, he has the right, the authority, and the power to define the nature of my being and my destiny. So basically the first point is just saying one of the first principles to grasp is who exactly I am, and particularly who exactly I am in relationship to God, in relationship to my Creator. That's crucial. If I don't get that, if I don't grasp that, or if I get that wrong, I can completely refashion Christianity into something entirely different from what the Bible is talking about. So getting the right take on who I am before my Creator, I think, is crucial. One of the things, I think we looked at this passage in Hebrews where he says, those who come to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of those who seek Him. Well, the believing that He is part, that's what I'm trying to grasp here. Believing that there is this God who's the author of all reality, that He is. And then later we'll get to the end, He's a rewarder of those who seek Him. Second point, my existence here and now is futile, empty, bitter, and disappointing when compared with the desires and expectations I have for my existence. The message of Ecclesiastes, I think, emptiness, emptiness, always just emptiness. If I don't have this perspective, then I won't come to belief, not to the belief that Jesus and the apostles were talking about. Because as long as I think that I can somehow wring meaning and significance and fulfillment out of the here and now in this life, then why would the gospel be interesting? It's only when I really come to terms with the fact that it ain't going to happen here, that this life is just not up to the task of really giving me the kind of fulfilling my existence in the way that God intended for it to be fulfilled. Until I get that, then I'm not going to be looking for eternal life. So this is crucial, I think. The third point, I was made by my Creator for a fuller and better existence than what can be attained in this present order of existence. I was made to transcend the present age of created reality and to find fulfillment in a future age of created reality yet to come. So it's not enough to know that this life is futile, empty, bitter, and disappointing. That just makes you cynical and cranky. But I also need to come to recognition that my Creator intended the longing of my heart to be fulfilled. It's just that it's not going to happen now. It's going to happen in the age to come. So that's the third point, is that hope, that expectation, that eager expectation that God will give me what I long for. Fourth point, if I am honest with myself, I am not worthy of this fuller and better existence that my heart longs for and that I was created for. Rather, I am deserving of punishment and destruction for the sort of person that I am. This is huge. And I lived for years as a Christian without grasping the significance of this and how central this is to faith. I mean, there's so many forces within Christian culture that try to make sin a problem of my past, not a problem of my present reality. This is what's crucial, is for me to recognize that even now, as a disciple of Jesus, as I stand here as a disciple of Jesus, even now, that an honest appraisal of myself would come to the realization that I'm not a good person. I'm a bad person. I'm an evil person. I'm an unworthy person. So anything that I get is going to be because of the mercy of God, not because of my righteousness, not because of my piety, not because of my godliness, not because of my obedience, but just purely and simply because God is going to be merciful. And I think this is so crucial, that if we are not personally on board with what number four says, there's no way in the world that we have what the Bible would call saving faith. We might be Christians, we might practice the Christian religion, but we don't have the faith of Jesus and the apostles. So this is absolutely central and crucial. Five, my Creator is a fundamentally merciful being who, even though I deserve destruction, will instead reward me with the fuller and better existence I long for if I will simply acknowledge Him as my Creator, accepting His authority over me, and acknowledge the truth in general, including and especially the truth about the Creator, about myself, about what the Creator has purposed within cosmic history, and about what the Creator has promised. So, mercy is mine, and all that's asked of me is that I bow my knee to the truth, that I acknowledge the truth as true. Then I will receive mercy, and that's what I can expect from the Creator. Let me actually finish and then we'll... This is another one that's huge. This is big. The gospel makes no sense if we don't understand that the gospel is fundamentally centered on the mercy of God. And then finally, number six, I have not acknowledged the truth in a way that will result in divine mercy unless I have embraced that truth existentially. I don't have a better word for that, sorry, but I'll try to define it. Unless I have embraced that truth existentially, what I mean by that is making it the very thing in terms of which I define myself and my existence. In order to be the recipient of divine mercy, I must embrace the truth in such a way that my every thought, action, choice, deed, and desire is judged by and guided by that truth. So to acknowledge the truth is not merely to give intellectual assent to the truthfulness of the truth, but it's to give actual personal investment it's to decide to personally invest in that truth. And that's what I mean by defining my very self and my very existence by that truth. It judges me and it guides me. If it doesn't judge me and it doesn't guide me, then I haven't really acknowledged that it's true. I may say that it's true, I may verbalize the fact that it's true, but I haven't really acknowledged that it's true if it doesn't change and transform how I act, think, choose, and desire. Now, what's probably most significant about this list is what it doesn't say. not so much what it does say. I mean, what it does say is probably not all that surprising. All these things can be found in the Bible, and I think you'd recognize all of them there. But what's most surprising about this is what it doesn't say. I mean, notice that I have the six essential principles of salvation according to the biblical worldview, and I don't mention Jesus once. So that's what's striking. That in leaving it out, I'm not saying that it's not an important part of the biblical worldview. I hope that's clear from the notes that we've already gone over, that Jesus is absolutely central to everything that God is doing. But this is a list of the things that are essential to grasp in order to be saved. We will all bow the knee to Jesus one day. But you don't have to know that you're going to bow the knee to Jesus, I think, in order to bow the knee to Jesus one day. You simply have to be the right sort of person who is God has prepared to have the right sort of heart and the right sort of orientation to Him, as I've tried to define here. But I think everyone with this kind of orientation is one who knows God, and as Jesus Himself said, anyone who knows God comes to the Son. So we will bow the knee to the Son one day if these six things characterize us. I've tried to construct this in such a way that it's plausible that Abraham would fit this description. That and Enoch and Noah and Lot and all the people of old would have fit this description. This stuff doesn't get spelled out in detail in the case of their lives, but it's certainly plausible to believe that all of these things would have been a reality in their lives. Richard?
Number five kind of brought a question in my mind. This may be a little off topic, but kind of what you're saying, I think it's a bit off topic. But evolution.
Okay.
And the reason why I'm bringing it up is because the way a lot of people are taught in school, you are just supposed to, if you've got any kind of mind at all, supposed to accept evolution. And so I believe that has led a lot of people to say, well, I'm a Christian, but I believe God used evolution. Now, I find that to be very, very troublesome because I think that denies Him as the Creator who fully is. Because I believe if you're a Christian and you acknowledge that God created this world, then He's not going to set something in motion to prove that He's going to do
it. Say that again.
He's not going to prove set something up and go to death. And I'm just kind of wondering your take on this. I mean, my feeling is not, I would not say to a Christian who believes in evolution, you're going to hell because you believe in evolution. I would say you have a very strong misunderstanding of who God really is.
Okay. On the one hand, I don't believe in evolution, but I don't believe in evolution because I think it makes absolutely no sense at all. I don't think it's fundamentally in conflict with theism. That is, theism, the existence of God. I mean, it would be, and it could be, depending upon how you understand evolution. I'm assuming that any Christian who believes in evolution, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'm assuming that any Christian who believes in evolution, whereas the secularist would say that there are these chance events and that it's these chance events that led to the appropriate mutations or something that then natural selection worked on and zippo bango, we got human beings eventually. I would assume that if they're Christians, they're not believing that it's a chance event. Now, if they are, and maybe that's what you were getting at, if they're really buying,
accept that because that's the very basis to evolution is
okay.
The idea of, now they'll deny it, but it comes out, the proof that things gradually become better and better and better.
Okay, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I am an absolute divine determinist. I mean, I believe every detail of everything that occurs is ultimately authored and shaped by God.
That's my biggest beef with evolution, because it leads, no matter how they want to hide it, say it doesn't exist, core to the belief is that things are getting better and better. You know, the evolution, progress of evolution is through everything, that it becomes more adaptable, stronger, smarter, whatever.
Okay. Well, I think that's absolutely right. That evolution as it is believed in our culture is a myth of origins that the religion, the secular religion of today, has bought. And it's every bit as silly as any polytheistic creation myth. It's just as silly. And several thousand years from now, people will look back and say, they believed what?
Oh, yes, exactly.
I mean, I just think that's how silly it is. And it's the fact that we don't experience it as silly is an indication of how deeply enculturated we are. So that myth and everything that it stands for and everything that it represents is representing a different, a very, very radically different religious worldview from the biblical religious worldview and the view of God. And to the extent that any Christian would try to have it both ways and combine and synthesize the two religions, then no, it can't be done. But I do think we need to be careful. Could God, who is totally and completely in control of everything, have done a creative act through a kind of process that we might call evolution? Well, logically, that's possible, sure.
Point number six.
Okay.
The last phrase. In order to be the recipient of divine mercy, I must embrace the truth in such a way that my every thought, action, choice, deed, and desire is judged by and guided by that truth. I think I know that your intent is that if that were on a true-false test, I would mark it true. But I don't think you intend to imply that we are entirely successful at carrying that out. Because we do not live up to our own standards in numerous things, including, I would say, not judging every thought, action, deed, desire by the truth that I believe the Bible would face into it.
Not even eventually?
Oh, no. If I were, okay, I guess I'm speaking existentially about how to live my life. None of us lives up to our own standards.
Right.
In most ways.
Well, what I mean, though, is, but wouldn't you cop to that fact eventually?
Oh, sure. Oh, no,
that's what I mean by judged by.
Okay.
I mean, that even when I fail, at least I call my failure a failure by the standards of this truth.
Yes, except I may not catch myself.
No, right.
I can talk to it voluntarily or immediately or spontaneously.
Yeah.
It sounds like a performance-based criterion, and I don't think that's how you mean.
Right. No, you're right. I mean, I just didn't deal with that. It's not that nuanced. But the issue is when God takes your face in his hand and points you into the reality of your sin and says, what's that?
Yeah.
Then what do you say?
How much satisfaction and fulfillment do you expect you to have in this life?
It depends on who you are. God doesn't deal with us all equally. And but what we can expect from our faith is that we can expect to experience our life as meaningful. I think it will have meaning, it will have purpose, it will have substance to it, because we've come to understand that I'm a creature created by a creator for a certain destiny, and he's aiming me at that, he's preparing me for that destiny in this lifetime. And so everything that happens can ultimately, I can experience it as being purposive and meaningful. It can be downright miserable for some of God's creatures. God is not a nice God. He doesn't promise me comfort. So, I mean, I remember the passage where Jesus is talking to Peter and is telling him that his end is not going to be all that pleasant. And he says, what about John, who's following them on the beach? And remember Jesus' response? It's something I, not exactly none of your damn business, but close. Yeah, close. It's,
what if I want him to live forever?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What if I want him to live forever? I mean, what's that to you? He's got his story. You've got your story. God will deal with him the way he's going to deal with him. He's going to deal with you the way he's going to deal with you. God deals with us individually. And it's just astonishing to me the kind of sorrow and grief and pain and misery that some people have to endure, even though they're children of God. I mean, just creatures. I mean, any human being. It's amazing what God calls upon some people to endure.
But it's not
Well, it's only fundamentally wrong to have a good time if your good time is shallow. And what I mean by that is that it's amazing how often in the New Testament the warning of the apostles is stay awake, be alert, be aware, be on guard, stay awake, be sober, another one. Sometimes our good time is frivolity in the worst sense of the word. Superficiality. It's living life on the extreme surface of life so that I don't have to ask any hard questions and I don't have to feel any of its sorrow and any of its grief and any of its pain. Well, then I'm not sober. And one of the things the apostles warns us is to be sober. Let face into and acknowledge the reality of this life and all that means. And what does that mean? We're looking at a world that's riddled with injustice and oppression and deceit and perversion. And we see all kinds of people victimized by that. We make people the victims of our own participation in evil. And ultimately, and I don't mean this literally, but I do mean this truly and profoundly, ultimately it should make us grieve. That's why Jesus said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." That is, my fundamental stance toward this life needs to be an orientation of some kind of grief and sorrow ultimately. Now, having said that, aren't there a lot of really, really wonderful gifts that God has given us in this creation that are just delightful? And is there anything wrong with delighting in what's delightful? No, not at all. That's what Paul says, I think, in one of his letters somewhere. where everything is sanctified by the word of God in prayer. I think he's talking about eating at that point.
Nothing is sanctified by the word of God in prayer.
Do you remember where that is?
Timothy.
Okay. So, I mean, he's basically taking the stand. Look, if God gives you the freedom from sorrow and pain and grief to enjoy the delightful gifts that he's put in his creation, do so and be grateful to him for the good gifts that he's given you. There's nothing to be gained by rejecting his good gifts. That's not sort of super spiritual to do that. But if we make use of it in the way that we ought to make use of it, namely to have it point us to our Creator with gratitude, then it's perfectly right to enjoy it. But enjoy his good gifts, recognize with gratitude who it is that's giving it to me, and be sober. Be a deep, substantial person, not a shallow, frivolous, silly person who's escaping the realities of the suffering of human existence. Okay.
On the other hand, you don't raise your children and teach them that I'm sorry, this is you, and this is you, and this is me. And you don't send them off to after you graduate and say, I'm sorry. The positive side of that.
You don't think I should use this for a graduation speech?
The other side of that is that this life is you. And I think what you would like me to internalize is that life is you. meaningful and purposeful. And that's the positive side of it. It may look a little bit loaded toward the negative side, but the positive is, and I think looking at life as purposeful and meaningful, it makes the time to rejoice good.
Right.
And the time to mourn.
Such that you can even count suffering joy if it's purposive and meaningful. Yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah.
And number five, can you explain accepting his authority over me? What that might look like?
Basically, that what I mean by that is that he really does have the right to define my existence, define the script of my life, the way my life is going to go. So if tragedy happens, he has the right to bring tragedy in my life. He has the right to bring death to the people I love, to bring paralysis to me, to end my life when he wants to end my life. And it's not that he's without the right to do that, because he gave me being, and as the creator, it was his purpose to shape my life for his purposes, to his end. I mean, all too often, I think we give the impression, I don't think anyone intends to give this impression, I don't think we do this wittingly, but within the church and the Christian culture, we give one another the impression that the reason God is there is to serve me. Mm-hmm. And it's just so fundamentally off-center. No, God isn't there to serve me. He created me to serve his purposes. And that's kind of what I'm getting at here. We need to accept that he has that kind of role in my life, to be the one who defines me, not to be my genie in the bottle to come through for me in time of need and help me. Yep.
As difficult as that can be, sometimes bringing a lot of grief and pain, just to think that the God of the universe created us for a purpose should also bring us great joy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, just to think, like Jesus, he said, you know, well, it was said in Hebrews, you know, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despised the shame, because he had an end purpose, you know, he had a hope.
Right.
And so I think we can, although there can be hard things in this life, I think we can find great peace in that.
Right. No, absolutely. I think that's the same point Keith was making. I agree with that. Probably that should be added to number two, that even though it is futile, empty, bitter, and disappointing, it is not meaningless. It is not insignificant. It is not without substance. Because we have been created by a God who has invested my existence with significance.
Yeah. Can you explain the every knee will bow part to your talk for baby Jesus and all? I know it's a really big question.
let's see. That would require me to understand what that means. Well, at the very least, it means that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He's absolutely the centerpiece of everything that God is doing. I probably said this before, but I think there are some passages that I think are probably mistranslated that are intended to say that the whole world was created for Jesus. Jesus is the whole reason that there even is a world, is because God wanted to embody himself in this man, Jesus, so that he would be the visible image of the invisible God and reign as king over a people that were gifts to him, that God created and gave as gifts to the Son. So he's the centerpiece of everything that God is doing. In a sense, he's the main actor and we're playing bit parts and props to this story that is being played out in the life of Jesus. So one way of getting at that is to call him King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and the phrase Paul uses in wherever, Ephesians, Philippians? Colossians? You know, one of his letters. Philippians, okay. That every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord. Now, I don't, without looking at the context more, I don't know what are all the implications of that are. But I think it's a way of getting at his supreme authority. Did you have a specific question about that?
Well, I just was trying to think of, I was thinking of all the verses like, no one comes to the Father but through me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At the same time, thinking of the people who are in a sense rejecting Jesus.
Okay, I don't think he's teaching the theological position called universalism, that in the end everybody will be saved. I don't think that's what he means there. I don't think he's saying that in the end everyone will believe and voluntarily and willingly bow the knee to Jesus as his servants. I don't think that's what he means. But I actually haven't studied that book in detail, so without looking at it in context, I couldn't be confident.
I'm wondering, the question is, why do you ask him for the name Jesus? Or why do you need that law? Yeah.
Of hearing me?
I don't know if I'm asking him, I guess.
Well, no, not exactly.
Where Jesus
no.
Came to this?
No. It's, if Jesus is the simple thing for all of this, how is it that everyone will come to realize that? I mean, literally, practically.
Well, I think the kind of thing that Paul has in mind there is they're either going to be saved by him or slain by him. But one way or the other, they're going to do business with Jesus in the end because he's King of Kings and Lord of Kings.
That's, I think, his clarification of this.
Okay.
I still don't understand why Jesus is such a necessary figure. Because the nature of existential decision doesn't really relate to Jesus. It's our relationship with God. It has to do with our relationship with God. Right? And God as the creator and all his nature, all his attributes of it, what he aspired towards. And it makes a lot of sense to me that Jesus is the God, that is the essential thing. And I have a hard time seeing him as anything other than just a sort of an illustration or another part of this, the narrative.
Yeah, I have several thoughts. I'm not sure I can remember them all and get them out at the same time. It's not that Jesus is left off of here. I just haven't named him by name. For example, my creator is a fundamentally number five. My creator is a fundamentally merciful being who, even though I deserve destruction, will instead reward me with the fuller and better existence I long for. If I will simply acknowledge him as my creator, accepting his authority over me, and acknowledging the truth in general, including and especially the truth about the creator, about myself, and about what the creator has purposed within cosmic history. Well, Jesus is central to that. He's central to what the creator God has purposed within cosmic history. And he's central to what the Creator has promised, the next line. So it's not that Jesus is not in this list. He is, but I just haven't spelled it out and named him by name. The other way in which he's in this list is, take number four. If I am honest with myself, I'm not worthy of this fuller and better existence, of this fuller and better existence that my heart longs for and that I was created for. Rather, I am deserving of punishment and destruction for the sort of person that I am. This is crucial. To come to this realization is crucial to believing that the Jesus hanging on the cross is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, the Son of God. I mean, if I don't believe this, the King of Kings being humiliated by the Romans on a cross makes absolutely no sense at all. it's only if I recognize that I need someone to offer up himself as a propitiatory offering on my behalf that Jesus hanging on the cross makes any sense. So it's believing these things that allow me to believe in Jesus. One of the points Kierkegaard makes is, how's he put it? Help me, Wes, the word that he uses,
contemporaneity. He invented a new word in my micro this year. Carson coined the term.
Okay.
What would Jesus do with it?
Okay. The point Kierkegaard is making is to believe in Jesus to your salvation is not to believe in Jesus from 2,000 years later, where you have 2,000 years of believing that Jesus is God incarnate and that Jesus is victorious and triumphant and raised and ascended and all the victory and triumph that goes with that. Because what the disciples were called upon to believe is that this person who got crucified by the Romans and that they lived with every day, who just seemed to be an ordinary human being like them, to believe that he was the Son of God. And Kierkegaard's point is, if we don't confront that Jesus and confess him as the Son of God, then we don't have faith. Because it's it's Jesus in his humiliation and in his suffering and in his death on the cross and in the shame that he experienced there. It's asking myself the question, do I believe that he is the Son of God? If I can answer yes to that, then I have faith. But how hard is it to believe that Lord of Lords, King of Kings, victorious, ascended, ruler of all reality is Son of God? Well, duh. Of course. But that's not the question. The question is this peasant from Galilee who got himself in trouble with the Romans and was completely humiliated and shamed and crucified, is he the Son of God? And in answering that, I have to have come to terms with number four on here before there's any way in the world that I'm prepared to answer yes to that, I would argue. So everything about Jesus is ultimately, this is the foundation for everything that we will and must believe about Jesus is laid if we believe this stuff. Okay, let's see. Forgot you. There's another point I was going to make.
Can I say something?
Sure.
I think a lot of people like him, and this is not an insult to you, but forget about how important blood is to redemption. And I think if you have an understanding of God's relation to blood, to covering of sins in the Old Testament, you understand that what they were doing in the Old Testament was covering these sins, where Jesus came and gave us what we needed to wipe out that sin.
Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important. That could sound like just really weird, bizarre magic. If we don't understand that what's behind that is number four here, we need to understand that the reason blood is important is because in the prescribed ritual that God gave the Jews in the Mosaic Covenant, he wanted us to come face to face with my unworthiness and the need for God's mercy. So the blood was appeal to God for that mercy.
Well, I kind of agree and disagree with you a little bit on that because I don't know how to say this politely, but I think sometimes we get too involved in philosophy. And I don't know. And the blood principle, I think, points directly to that. And partly, I think, one of the reasons why I grasped it so much is because I've done a study of so many cultures. And blood is just all over the place, really. And I think kind of what modern philosophy has done is in some ways forgot some of the past that has come up to what existentialism is. In other words, they have the shell, but they're missing the root.
for the foundation.
So you think something real about blood, something metaphysically real about blood, is more basic than the existential realities?
Yes, I think it's kind of a foundation for building of the existentialism that's above it, because I feel that it was a base for, how can I say this, to believe in a religion that something that's physical will get rid of something that is, quote, in the spiritual realm. That requires, there's a great deal of philosophical thinking behind that to, like, this is something physical.
Okay, well, yeah, you and I don't see eye to eye on that. Okay. I see the physical as merely symbolic and signifying the spiritual and the...
Yes, it does. I'm not denying that.
Okay.
I'm just saying that for a person to grasp that idea that something in the physical world, this particular act, has impact in the spiritual world, requires some type of philosophical grasp. And you may disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that.
I have a question on item number 3 there, where it says, I was made to transcend the present age of created reality. Does that mean I was brought onto this planet to transcend this normal reality of living here, and then to find fulfillment in a future age of created reality yet to come, meaning the kingdom of heaven?
Right.
Okay, so then, if I'm going to find fulfillment, it says, in a future age of created reality yet to come, does that mean that the kingdom of heaven is like currently running and on board? Or does that mean that everybody's going to have to wait to a certain point in history?
I'm inclined to think, the way I imagine it is that it's that we're all waiting for another point in history. When this is present reality has been destroyed, this heavens and earth has been destroyed, uh-huh. Then a new one is created. But I really don't know. I mean, if God knows a way to have them running concurrently, then that's fine. I mean, that's his business. But I don't picture it that way. I picture it as this coming to an end and being destroyed, and then God creating a new heavens and a new earth where we will have a place there.
We've got about 4 more hours, so.
Till this is destroyed. I heard somebody saying today that somebody went back to see what was happening on January 6th, 1906?
June
6th. Yeah, or June 6th, yeah. Not much.
I like to have a question because I thought that myself in back when I was doing the Navigator the first model. And I thought about how that has changed in my life since then. And every time I try to think through the way that I would explain it now, I have to get into the divine determinism part of it. And you kind of left that off.
Well, why do you think you have to get into that?
Because I think it's so foundational to what I believe in.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would, even though I try to leave it off, I'd probably get there eventually as well if I was talking about it. If I literally were evangelizing, though, I think I would try to avoid that and just stick to what's on here. It may very well be that they're going to ask the kind of question that makes it unavoidable that I have to take that up, and I'm certainly not afraid to go there, and I'm not ashamed of going there. I mean, I just think it's the truth. And I think, as outlandish as it sounds to people in our culture, I think people will handle it if God has chosen them. It won't bother them. But I don't think I would put it right up front and center, just because it is so such a different paradigm, such a different worldview, that I guess I just don't want to talk that long.
excuse me, I didn't hear the question. What was the assertion you were talking about?
That it seems inevitable that you'd have to bring up divine determinism, God's sovereign control over all reality, because it's so foundational to a biblical worldview that how can I leave this off of here? And I mean, that the how is from the standpoint of what's essential for them, they have a choice and they're going to make that choice in their freedom. And that's what I'm wanting to appeal to here is what do you want to do? What do you want to do with your life? Do you want to acknowledge your Creator or not acknowledge your Creator? Do you want to acknowledge your unworthiness or not acknowledge your unworthiness? And basically, these end up being a series of choices that they need to make. And even believing divine determinism, part of what I believe is they're the ones that are going to decide that in their freedom. So that's what I'm going to appeal to, is their freedom.
And that's why you can leave it off, because in our day-to-day existence, in our story that He has created, we live by an exercise of free will.
Fire, yeah.
We make choices. So that is behind the scenes.
Right.
And not necessary
to where I live.
Even though it's a part of the whole picture.
Right.
What we understand is that today I have a choice to make.
Right. And that's what I would emphasize. That's where I would focus.
How was that
question?
Is there any possibility where a person will never number seek to people they never actually heard about the little gospel of Christ to come to a basic mercy?
I think so. That's the whole point in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, is that there are all these people who they're not Christians per se, but yet the point that he's trying to make is, but nonetheless they had faith. Their faith was faith. And the one we know the least about is Enoch. And the argument is made as, well, he did something right, because he didn't die, he got taken. So he must have done something right. And that's where that famous passage is. Well, what could it be that he did right? Well, we know that he at least had to believe that God was, and that he was a rewarder of those who seek him. So I think that's fundamentally right. I don't know why they make a distinction in their destinies, though, because it seems to me from the biblical perspective, my destiny is no different than Enoch's. I mean, the fact that I have bowed the knee to Jesus explicitly and I have confessed Jesus as Lord explicitly doesn't mean I'm more righteous than he is. It just means I live at a different time in history and have been confronted with a different set of realities and a different set of truths and have responded to them. But Enoch is going to respond to those too whenever somebody lets him know.
Yeah, so pretty much what you're way here would apply to, it's like all ages, you know, we find all times.
Yeah.
Past,
I think so.
That's what I like about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Pat?
I'm going to get you in big trouble.
Okay.
Big trouble. I just got done with a book, an excellent book. Best book I've read in years by Abraham Heschel.
Okay.
Called The Prophets.
I know the author. I have not read that book.
I would recommend it, definitely. He lays out every one of these things. And number six, to shame Christians, really turned my thinking around in a lot of areas.
Abraham Heschel, by the way, is a Jew.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of funny when he's going through Isaiah 40 on. He, of course, he's a Jew, so he portrays Israel as a suffering servant. And in the notes, in one area, it's a big, long section, but in one of the notes, he said, well, you know, the suffering servant is Israel, whether it's the nation, the movement within Judaism, or an individual within Judaism. It seemed like he was trying to hedge his bets before he got to the pearly gates. But he still was a Jew. And he went, you know, I understand why you did this, so that, you know, we can embrace our Old Testament brethren and see that, you know, we are one family. But as you know, the acceptance of stupid philosophies like evolution, or you know, not even getting into divine determinism because it's so so silly, so foreign. Wouldn't it still be true that, well, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you? There are really reasons, good reasons, someone would reject Jesus because of Jesus portrayed to them as evil. You know, if the Gentiles who do not know the law are a law unto themselves, or keep the righteousness of the law, aren't they a law unto themselves? That's kind of, you know, the conclusion I had to come to with Herb Heschel. Isn't just as evolution or divine determinism something that, you know, you really don't have to grasp as long as you grasp this? You know, and we do grasp things existentially that are, you know, creates conflict in our mind and we just sublimate it. Doesn't that even extend to Jesus?
Extend to belief about the doctrines of Jesus, you mean?
Well, no, about the person of Jesus.
Okay. Yeah, in principle, I don't know why it couldn't. And let me explain what I think you mean, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. But I mean, let's use your example. I mean, we had an Orthodox rabbi come and speak at one of our conferences a few years ago, and same as Heschel, it seems entirely possible, given the heart and the spirit of the man and what makes him tick, that he is being born of the Spirit of God. And God owns him, has him, and is putting his mark on him. Now, if you ask him, does he believe in Jesus? His response is, I'm a Jew. Of course I don't believe in Jesus. I can't believe in Jesus. I'm a Jew. Which is crazy. I mean, it's a crazy idea, but that is a deep, deep, deep-seated cultural prejudice within Judaism today, is that to believe in Jesus would be to actually negate my Judaism. Now, some Jews get past that, but actually they tend to be coming from more secularized Jewish families that get past that. People who are deeply embedded in religious Judaism have a very, very difficult time getting past that. Well, is that a spiritual resistance to Jesus as Lord? Maybe. I mean, God's ultimately going to have to decide that. But it seems theoretically possible that it's just a cultural blindness, a cultural prejudice that they can't get past. And instead of clearing up the cultural prejudice, God is just underneath that cultural prejudice, sanctifying them anyway, in spite of their ignorance about who Jesus is, and it's just going to sanctify them anyway. And then in the end, they'll recognize Jesus for who he is. I mean, this rabbi told me a joke. I'm terrible at joke telling, so I can't get it. But it was when Jesus comes, the first question we're going to ask him is, "Have you been here before?" I mean, he didn't say it as Jesus, but when the Messiah comes, the first question we'll ask him is, "Have you been here before?" But I mean, that I think the reason he liked and appreciated that joke is because in his mind, in the end, it really would be okay with him if he was wrong about that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's huge. Seems to me.
That's the way it struck me when I read Heschel's note. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's kind of strange.
Okay.
How would you explain Romans chapter 9?
Unless you believe in your heart, that one, or? No, that's 10.
No, Romans 9, verse. I'll give you the context too.
Do you mean 10:9?
10. Well, what
Paul talked about he wishing that he could, he would be, if the law said that his brethren would be saved.
9:3?
Yes. Yes. 9 from verse 1 to, I think 5 would be fine.
Okay. I'm telling the truth in Christ, I'm not lying. My conscience testifies with me in the Holy Spirit that I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart. For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ, for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption as sons, and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the temple service and the promises, whose are the fathers and whom is the Christ according to the flesh, who is over all, God blessed forever. Amen. That. And so your question is, if what I'm saying about this rabbi is right, how is that consistent with Paul, what Paul is saying here?
Yeah, because he goes on to say that he can attest that they are working hard to please God, but they are kind of running fast in the wrong direction.
Right. Okay.
I can't find that. It's somewhere near here anyway.
That's in 10:2-3, for I testify about them that they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge, for not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. Is that the one you're...
Yes. And then, yeah, verse 4 kind of summarizes.
For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. Right. Okay, well, that's true. If this rabbi ultimately does not believe in God because he is unwilling to submit to the righteousness of God and he's seeking to establish one of his own, then he'd be in exactly the same category as Paul's contemporaries that he's writing about when he writes that. And for Paul, what Paul understands the Jews of his day, I mean, the problem is the Jews of his day are in a very different situation than they are in our day. The Jews in his day really have no excuse. These are people who saw some of the miracles of Jesus. They knew that Jesus raised from the dead, that the tomb was empty. I mean, those were not ancient history to them. That was in their lifetime. So they don't have the excuse that some Jews today might have about the facticity of the evidence, the supernatural attestedness of Jesus being the Christ. So why is it that they don't believe that Jesus is the Christ? Well, because they don't get number 4, basically, on my list. They don't understand that they're not worthy. And so they're not really in the market for the mercy of God and the grace of God and God's eternal life coming to them as a gift. They're not open to that, because they're still convinced that they are completely capable of demonstrating to God their own worthiness by keeping the Mosaic covenant that he's given to them, as they understand that, as they understand keeping that covenant. And as long as one whole chapter of Romans is devoted, I would argue, to the argument in Romans 7, the early part of Romans 7, is devoted to an argument where basically what he's saying is, just like a woman can't go off and marry a new husband when her old husband is still alive, the old husband has to be dead before she can marry a new one. Paul is saying, I recognize that my Pharisaical brethren, there's no way in the world that they're going to be free to be married to the gospel of Jesus Christ as long as the marriage to righteousness by the covenant, by the Mosaic covenant, is still a valid option, a viable option to them. They're going to be married to that until that marriage is dead, until that man dies, until that husband dies. That has to no longer be a viable option to them before they are free to be married to another. And in seeking to establish a righteousness of their own, basically they've redefined righteousness. God never intended it. Even in the time of Moses, he never intended it. But they have construed the Mosaic covenant as being a means by which they can keep the law, these ordinances and judgments and statutes, and then stand before God at the judgment seat and go, not half bad, eh? Didn't I do pretty good? And expect a verdict from God, well done, good and faithful Jew. And Paul is saying, until you understand that the demands of the law crush you, the demands of the law are so exacting and so pure and so pure in their goodness and their godliness that there's no way in the world you could ever measure yourself as worthy by that standard. Until you get that, there's no way that you'll be open to justification coming to you just as a gift of God's mercy and God's grace. So what he's talking about in both these passages is his longing that they would come to see that, and that that obstacle to their receiving the Christ would be removed. But he's not envisioning any other obstacle to them coming to Christ other than their self-delusion about their own worthiness. Because that's been the case throughout the Jews' history. They just haven't got it. And Paul as much as says so later in Romans, that a blindness has come upon them and it's with us still till this present day. And I'm not confident that the same is still not true of this rabbi that we're talking about and even Abraham Heschel. I don't know that same blindness that Paul is talking about isn't affecting them as well.
Anybody is going to be a rabbi, fundamentally, it's what's the prisoner for everybody else and what they do. You know, what rules they follow, that's what separates the Jewish, the foods you eat, those is one big one, for example, Sabbath, and so if he thinks that being a Jew is, that if you stop doing those, you won't be a Jew anymore, and therefore I must keep my Jewish identity, it means I must continue to establish a righteousness of some sort, based on what food I eat, what type of things I do, and so it seems that, he doesn't want to embrace the freedom in Christ, so that's a dilemma, and at one point, it really has to pass, and I'd say, if you don't put your faith in Christ and stop and rest, like Hebrews says, you are working, you're stressing out, and God, God is not happy with you.
Okay, I think if I followed you, I think I do have a slightly different understanding of things. Paul, for example, one of the last things he does before he gets arrested is he goes into the temple and pays whatever is needed to be paid, the redemption price, the ransom price, and offers the offering for some people who've taken a Nazirite vow, for some young men who've taken a Nazirite vow. Well, a Nazirite vow is even optional in Judaism. That's not even required in the law. You don't have to do it. If you do it, here's how you do it, but you don't have to do it. So Paul, one of his last acts as a free man, was to perform an act that was deeply Jewish, deeply and profoundly Jewish. I don't think Paul had any problem with Jews being Jews and Jews keeping the covenant. The dietary regulations, circumcision, Sabbath keeping, and all that kind of stuff. Paul recognized that that's just part of Judaism. His problem, I don't think he had the view that if you really want to be saved, you need to free yourself up from keeping the requirements of the law as the Jews do and stop being Jewish. I think rather his perspective was what God intended in us keeping the law was that through our keeping the law, we would come to understand and come to deeply, profoundly understand how far short we fall of the goodness that God wants of us. I mean, anybody can keep the Sabbath. Anybody can offer the right kind of offering. Anybody can do the trivial, superficial parts of the law. But the law is more than those trivial, superficial things. It also has this vision of moral goodness, of godliness, that's very profound. Love your enemy. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Those things are not trivial. Those things are profound and substantive commandments. And if I took those things seriously, the only conclusion I could reach in my attempt to keep the law as a Jew would be, God, I'm not a very good person. I don't naturally love my neighbor. I don't naturally love you, God. I'm not a good person. God, forgive me. God, have mercy upon me. I am woefully inadequate. Well, that's not where Judaism went, though. Judaism didn't end up with the tax gatherer and the sinner going, God, have mercy upon me, a sinner. It ended up with the Pharisee. God, I'm just thank you to this day, this lovely day. I thank you that I am so much better than everyone else in the world. I am just so grateful that you've made me such a specimen of righteousness. That's where they ended up, is because they were blind to their performance by the law. They looked at all the trivial stuff that they did do and got an exaggerated view of their moral and spiritual worth, and they just totally didn't look at the evidence of all the ways in which they didn't perform the law. And that's what Jesus and Paul, I think, are, that's central to what they're criticizing Phariseeism for, is their self-deception, their self-delusion. Is you have not seen yourself the way what the law reveals you to be, you have not seen it. You have not acknowledged it. So it's not the actual performance of the things of the law that is the problem to Jesus and Paul.
Yeah, it's the fact that he's taking out something more than a shadow.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the fact is that the way people are traditions, you know, shows that there's a lot more attached to it.
Exactly.
If you feed a Jew a kid, you're going to be in trouble.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Simply because you have challenged, you know,
right,
their righteousness.
Right.
Like that. You know, I'm not saying you should go and be culturally insensitive, you know, but the fact is that, you know, Paul clearly, you know, crossed the line for many people when he said, forget about the Sabbath day.
Right.
Yeah, he did. Jesus crossed the line when he had his disciples eat on the, you know, from the field on the Sabbath day.
Right.
And, you know, if I was a Jew, I would just stay away from all those traditions just to make sure my heart doesn't get too entwined, but that's me. Yeah.
Okay.
Question regarding evangelical Christianity, the Great Commission, basically the notion that we should try to convert as many people to Christianity as possible. Correct me to what extent I may be wrong on this, but I get the distinct impression, I think, probably
explicitly stated before, that the Reformation theology
views such concepts as inherently fallacious and fundamentally unbiblical, right? And I was wondering if that's the case, what's the justification?
No, I don't think it would. I mean, it depends. I'm a divine determinist, but there's nothing I would rather do than be a midwife to someone being born from above. Mm-hmm. And if any opportunity that would come my way to be able to talk and plead and exhort and beg someone to bow their knee to the truth, I would do that. I mean, that just because God needs me? No. I mean, if I don't do it, a donkey or a rock will do it. I mean, God can use any resources he needs to get his message to people and to get them to respond to his truth. But it's fun. You know, it's fulfilling, it's rewarding to be a part of something that substantial and that eternal, an event that transforms somebody that permanently. It would be really fun to have a role to play in that. So the fact that somebody believes in the sovereignty of God doesn't have to, nor should it, make them kind of passive with respect to evangelism, I shouldn't think. Now, there is a perspective on evangelism that I think is fallacious, and that is, if I don't go tell them, then they're going to go to hell, and it's my fault because I should have gone and told them, and that's fallacious.
Okay. Right. As a little side question, had a conversation from a student from Germany who claimed that her mom was very much a religious studies work, particularly in the Bible, and she somehow allegedly proved that the verse in the Bible that Jesus says right before he ascends into the sky, you know, giving the Great Commission, saying that everyone, you know, you guys should go and preach the gospel around the world and all this sort of thing. Allegedly, that statement was made up by some pope after Jesus, and just was added to the Bible and wasn't in the original Bible. What would you? I mean, does that have any basis at all? What
would that proof look like?
I have no idea. And she just was so confident that it was just completely, didn't happen, never said it. I was like, really? Okay.
Well, you have to. When you get into academic biblical studies, that is one mighty weird game. And all kinds of assertions get made that's true. They're playing by the rules of that game. But it's a game I'm not interested in playing. It's a game that doesn't get you any closer to the truth. It's a game that is not even about truth. It's about getting a doctoral dissertation and a degree, you know. So I frankly don't have a lot of respect for that, nor do I give it any credence. Those proofs, I can only guess what such a proof would look like. But
Jesus said, something even Jesus said, that the apostles. So are sent out. But I agree totally with you that if they're sent out with the idea that we don't get to these people, you know,
But there's all kinds of streams of Jesus' teaching that would just make it completely plausible that what he would want is for as many people as possible to hear this message so that they can come to eternal life. I mean, that just makes a ton of sense to me. So I mean, I wouldn't even ask the question whether that one was authentic. There might be other passages that I might wonder whether it was authentic, but that wouldn't even occur to me to wonder about it because it just makes so much sense. Joshua?
I just want to point out real quick that, you know, actually, I personally probably know, I don't quite know where I really be about determinism and all that.
About what?
About determinism.
I haven't
made my mind yet. But I know I come from Nigeria and Africa, and before the gospel came to us, and now there's a night and day difference. And I thank God the gospel came and is still coming to certain regions. You just change the lives of people and it made a big difference.
I think we forget what a huge impact on every culture that the gospel has gone to. What a huge impact. Civilizing, making people more decent, making even when they don't become real believers, which is just the truth of Christianity itself, as Jesus says, it's the light shining in the darkness. I mean, it actually civilized humanity for centuries, and I think we forget that. I mean, we get so accustomed to civilization that we forget we didn't always used to be civilized. And Christianity had a huge role to play in bringing about that, in transforming cultures.
I think, I feel like when you're just talking about the game of the
academic biblical studies,
it seems important to me to always remember that there is this, there can be this game mindset for evangelism too, that is more, can be about the people who are called to be these leaders too. And I know there it's a whole mixed bag, but just that it's so easy, I think, for that mixed in there to be that this power thing, and maybe that's what was being referred to earlier about before the Reformation. You would see how the Catholic Church, how things snowballed into just the power of those who were bringing the truth to others. And I mean,
can you think of an when you say it can be a game? Can you think of an example? Give me an example of the kind of.
Well, I guess just thinking of how, well, today it's like, go to Christian college, be, you know, become a leader, bring in the numbers that will. And like you say, as many as possibly can should hear the genuine truth about Christ. But it just, there's always, it's just the human element.
Oh, absolutely.
The numbers game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the most treacherous thing we have to deal with, is the constant temptation that we have as human beings to turn our faith just into a culture, and to think that our task is simply to enculturate people into our culture. It's really hard. I mean we all do it, but I have to keep reminding myself that the students that I'm teaching and the people who come into my life that I'm having any kind of effect on, I don't measure whether they're getting it by whether they're starting to look like me and talk like me. But it's incredibly tempting, because I don't recognize them if they're not talking like me and looking like me. But I have to keep reminding myself, no, they're their own creature, and they are answerable to their creator on terms that their creator is dictating to them, not me. I'm not a part of that equation. All I can do is share the wisdom and knowledge and understanding that God has given me, and then they're going to have to embrace it and acknowledge it and learn from it and deal with it and do business with their creator on their own terms. But it's incredibly difficult to do that. And so especially if you get a bunch of us together in a church or a Christian culture or a Christian institution, we really expect people to conform to our cultural expectations about what spirituality looks like, what faith looks like, what goodness looks like, what righteousness looks like. It's really hard to resist that, but we should. Yeah.
Well, on the flip side of that, people want to hear that sometimes too. So it's on the people that are hearing it sometimes just want to change because someone, you know, be like you.
Mm-hmm.
So then that makes it even worse.
Right. No, exactly.
Or easier to then have that relationship and continue it.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just thinking of the flip side of the other people too.
Yeah, that's exactly.
We want to belong as human beings.
Right. Yeah, and that's why there's a difference between becoming a Christian that's recognizable to a given person or culture and actually believing. Those are not the same thing. Because oftentimes all I'm doing is out of some kind of psychological and emotional needs, wanting to belong, and I respect a group of people or a community of people, and so I do what's necessary to assimilate into that community. Have I confronted Jesus and believed the gospel? Ah, that's another question. It's a different question.
As a 15-year-old, that's probably exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was okay.
Sure.
In time, God used that.
Yeah. So yeah, that's right.
You don't always come with full knowledge or with good intent.
Right. Some of us snuck in the back door. No, that's exactly right. It's been fun. Thank you. And we'll see you in the fall.